St. Louis a couple weeks ago. I can now answer a question somewhat differently from what I had to answer a while back in Chicago. This fellow comes up to me and says, I think I know you. He says, I think I saw you in St. Louis in August. And I said, no, I don't think so, because I wasn't in St. Louis in August. And he says, neither was I. It must have been two other fellows. The humor, of course, is a sense of unreality and illogic. And similarly, there's a sense of unreality about the ministry today, I think. And especially a kind of illogic when one talks about the ministry in relationship to the kingdom of God, in relationship to the destiny of human history and what it is that men walk and long for. So I hope that I will speak to and not increase the sense of unreality as we talk about the ministry of the church and the minister as a politician of God's future. When I was in college, Paul Whitman writes, passage 31, we thought, justifiably or not, that a student going in for the ministry was probably a moron, intellectually on the level of candidate for officer in the army, but less sexy. Today, the estimate would be that he is more intellectual and probably more spirited than the average. Mr. Goodman suggests that the ministry wins many students by default, since the other professions have become arid or have sold out. There are some studies to indicate that students entering the ministry often start with engineering, which promises good money. They move over to pure science, but find it does not make for human fulfillment. Then to the social sciences, and quick disillusionment with all that. And finally, they end up in the humanities, and then they drop out. The ministry is partly being in the humanities and partly dropping out. There is an increasing number of young men who want to be where the action is, as the phrase goes. And in recent years, the ministry, for those who will it to be that, has become the name of the activist's game. The style struck by the Malcolm Boyds and Daniel Berrigans is not, of course, representative of the church's ministry by a long shot, but it is becoming more representative. We are already well beyond the point where clerical collars and the picket lines of protest and social advocacy automatically make news. This development should be examined closely. While it may indicate that the church is becoming relevant, entering the marketplace, engaging men where they are, and all the other in things which the church is supposed to be doing, it may also be a sign of an unhealthy blossoming of individualistic clericalism. The activist cleric is frequently, or at least sometimes, unrelated in any meaningful way to a church community. And while he may think that he is bringing the church to the arena of social change, he may in fact be bringing little more than his private enthusiasms and his calling. The church is alone among major institutions in maintaining a professional class in which freedom of expression is as unlimited as a man has will and courage to exercise it. This is not to say that the clergy are not squelched and intimidated. Dismissals from pulpits and podiums of those who become too controversial in their advocacy of racial justice, world peace, or reasonable theology are not infrequent. Nor is it to suggest that denominations are equally tolerant of outspoken criticism or unpopular causes. But it is true, it seems to me, that any man of normal competence can find a recognized place within the church's ministry, no matter how disagreeable the minority viewpoint with which he identifies. While there are still 10 clergymen giving bland benedictions at the Rotary Club for everyone marching for the poor, and while the types represented by the Spellmans of the church and the aspiring Spellmans, aspiring the successors of the Spellmans, while they far outnumber the Berrigans, the style of this new ministry is individualistic, an uninhibited indulgence of ego and idiosyncrasy. Then the occupancy of the promised land will be deservedly short-lived. Not long ago, a seminarian was explaining in some detail to a veteran of the ministry why it was he wanted to be a pastor. And after listening patiently to the young man's talk about mission, vocation, discipleship, and such, the older pastor responded, "There is one reason why I think you want to be ordained. That is that you believe the ministry will offer you maximum opportunity for self-expression. And the sadness is that you are probably right." A lively seminarian who is attracted to the promised freedom of this profession must decide early about being a clerical exhibitionist or a minister of the church and an agent of the coming kingdom. The difference is not between being a conservative or a radical. The difference is between private crusade and churchly vocation, between the search for ego satisfaction and the communal quest for man's destiny. Of course, the happy clergyman, I suppose, is the one in whom crusade and vocation, ego satisfaction and kingdom, coincide in a way that is credible to the church and credible to himself. But the ministry is always the ministry of the church. Leaving aside for the moment the dimension of divine institution, it is obvious that ordered ministry is part of the institutionalized life of the Christian community. And since no community of serious intent fails to develop institutions, we ought not quarrel with our role as functionaries of this community. It is unfortunate, it seems to me, that some clergy are so defensive about their professional placement that they constantly travel various forms of anti-clericalism. They talk about a non-institutional Christian community, and even about a church without clergy. All of this is little more than a fanciful regression to a primitive church that probably never was and certainly is not a live option today. Sociologist Oliver Whiteley notes that in those sects which reject the notion of an ordered ministry, the assertion that everybody is a minister means that nobody is a minister. Seminarians would do well to get over any psychological hang-ups about belonging to a professional caste. Anti-clerical clerics who want to be, as they put it, just authentic persons in a community of authentic persons test the patience of their fellow Christians and appear ludicrous in the eyes of the public. The ordained priest of the church is, among other things, a professional, and should early come to terms with his professional role. We should not fear to consider ourselves organization men if we remember the uniqueness of the organization by which we are claimed. First, it is an organization of universal scope, for we recall that none of us are ordained into the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, or into the United Presbyterian Church, USA, but into the ministry of the Church of Jesus Christ. Into our organization, or community if you prefer, as a point of reference beyond itself, namely God and his coming kingdom. Thus we are not inhibited, and our style ought not to be cramped. For the Church's point of reference beyond itself not only permits, but makes imperative the word of criticism and of judgment. To be a faithful minister of the church is not to conform to the conventionalities and denominational divisions of the period, but to work in constant response to the universal community and its destiny. What we do for the church, that the church may be for the world. The ministry is not a platform from which to operate, but a call to fulfill. When I commit myself to be ordained, my professional fate is inextricably linked to the fate of the church, as in baptism was my personal fate so linked. It would be odious to embrace the ministry for its professional possibilities while despising the church which gives that ministry shape. I believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic church, means that I believe in the lively possibilities of the Christian community to provoke man's potential and to bear his hope. All of which is to say what should be obvious, but obviously is not, that ministers should be churchmen. The minister holds an office in and of the church. He is not simply a leader spontaneously selected by a congregation, but a symbol of unity for the whole Christian community. Thus, the ordained minister can move from parish to parish and into ministries only remotely related to any parish form, and still be recognized as a bearer of the whole community's order. This is why ministry is such a crucial question in ecumenical discussions, and why denominational restrictions are such an intolerable offense, such a scandal against the minister. The ministry is also the bearer and the interpreter of the church's memory, remembering and interpreting the tradition. The process of traditioning the tradition is a serious business which requires a disciplined order. The church trains, ordains, and commissions men to the task, and we accept it. The memory of the Christian community, more particularly the memory of Jesus and the community's interpretation of him, supplies the resources for our envisioning the world's future. Preserving a tradition may seem to some to be a task more suited to the temperament of a scribe than of a revolutionary. But those who deem this a dismal job fail to grasp or be grasped by the radical character of the memory which is to be recalled and interpreted. The memory of which we are ministers is not so much a remembrance of things past as a yearning for things to be. It is the memory of a hope and of a promise which encompass our present and our future. Thus, to be faithful to our past is to come to terms with our tomorrow. Our memory is of Ezekiel's word of the Lord, I myself will be the shepherd of my people, and I will make them lie down, and I will seek the lost, and I will bring back the strayed, and I will bind up the crippled, and I will strengthen the weak, and the fat and the strong I will watch over. I will feed them in justice. The memory of which we are ministers is the memory of Micah's. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation. Neither shall they learn war anymore, but they shall set every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. To celebrate that memory, to recall that past, is to anticipate the future. For I tell you, Jesus says, that from now on I shall not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes. Loyalty to this tradition makes the radical programs of men pale by comparison. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and I saw the holy city, a new Jerusalem, and I heard a great voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with men, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be with them. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. This is the communal memory of which we are ministers, in its world embracing in its scope, drastic in its promise, restive in its fulfillment. Commitment to the kingdom makes impossible an exclusive preoccupation with matters religious, for God's purpose comprehends the whole of his creation. Commitment to the kingdom means that we understand the provisional character of human programs for reform, the most radical of which are but faint clues to God's design. Commitment to the coming kingdom means a persistent restlessness and discontent with the world as it is, and it means our thorough identification with the company of those, Christian and non-Christian alike, who long for the triumph of justice and love. Our hope is more than the totality of embattled mankind's aspirations, all of which, in the eyes of the world's more moderate readers, may be suspect as wishful illusion. Our hope is consonant with our understanding of reality, and undergirded by the history of the resurrection of Jesus, in which the presence of God's rule is already proclaimed. Ours is no evolutionary theory of inevitable progress, nor elegant assumption. resurrection is an invitation to freedom. In this light, we see the falseness of the antithesis implied in the title of a recent book on parish renewal called From Tradition to Renewal. Far from tradition being antithetical to renewal, it is through this lively tradition that renewal is possible. The true traditionalist in the Christian community must be a restless soul. To be Catholic is to be revolutionary. Those ministers who think they must hang loose from the church in order to be modern men are, I believe, on the wrong track, and all too often end up as case studies in cultural accommodation, pressed in the mold of society's prevailing patterns. So eager can we be to stay in step with the thought of current passion that we no longer march to the drumbeat of the coming kingdom. For those who are faithful ministers of the tradition, not the secular city, but the New Jerusalem is the goal. And if in the secular city we catch some glimpse of the New Jerusalem, let us rejoice at the sight, but not lay down our burden. The secular city can provoke us on our pilgrimage, but it dare not become our resting place, nor be confused with our destination. We cannot close our eyes to the limitations and provisionality of every wastage and every revolution, every social reform, every just cause. We should rejoice in the good which they offer, and even have the maturity to be prepared to lay down our lives for the fulfillment of whatever kingdom possibilities, no matter how preliminary they possess. But we must persist in urging our fellows to press on. To surrender the tradition, to abandon the Christian community of hope, is to content ourselves with the flesh pots of Egypt and to betray the revolution to which God has called us and to which he has pledged himself. It is appealing, indeed exciting, to be a minister of the church in search of the coming kingdom. But perhaps that is not the church of our own experience. We know the churches that are bastions of reaction, dedicated to keeping the lid on social change. We know the church that seeks to rule rather than to serve, to possess rather than to search. We know the church that blasphemously proclaims its petty programs to be the work of the kingdom of God and arrogantly asserts a monopoly on the work of God in the world. We know the church that peddles the magic of getting dirty little souls into heaven and literally gives no more than a damn about the fulfillment of man on earth. We know the church that preens itself on the privileges bestowed by corrupt principalities and seems always ready to sell out the kingdom hope for present advantage. We know this church too well. It is the church of the Grand Inquisitor in Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov. It is the old maidish church guarding society's twisted sexual mores, lending credence to the suspicion that God is inordinately concerned about humanity from the waist down. It is the cowardly church that, through its armed forces commission, surrounds our soldiers with God's care while having scarcely a word of hope for the creation which is defiled by those for whom we care. We know the church that is not above supplying chaplains for the guards and Auschwitz. We know the church that has silently held up a crucifix to be kissed by the heroes of humanity before they fall under the blessed bullets of their tormentors. We know the church of persistent hostility to the coming kingdom. And to be a minister of that church is unworthy of any man. While we are repelled by that church, however, we cannot be isolated from it. For that church is inextricably linked to the church of the kingdom. Such is the present condition of humanity, and we must still recognize the truth of Luther's Simul Justus et Reformat. We recognize what H. Richard B. Ford termed the Christ of culture and the church of culture which results from that. But in fact, we recognize that the situation is even more serious than Mr. B. Ford described. For we see that it is a church of a subculture, considerably below the sensibilities of the modern world at its best. But the Church of the Kingdom, the Church of the Kingdom is on the ascendancy. I believe that an accurate reading of our times makes that clear. And even the church below culture, pregnant with possibilities, for it has not abandoned entirely the literature and the rites of the tradition. And thus it harbors in its bosom an explosive power, waiting only to be ignited by men of courage. The church below culture may be happy to make mud pies by the rivers of Babylon, but still it sings the songs of Zion. It may slander the peacemaker and smear with red the radical, but still it venerates a crucified dissenter. It may obsequiously scrape before the powers that be, but still it insists that only one is Lord. It may succumb to the narrowness of nationalism, but still it identifies with one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church, transcending demarcations of nation and ideology. The church below culture is unavoidably schizophrenic, and it is for us to help it emerge in its true colors of the kingdom. It is emerging, and to the ministry of that emergent church, of the coming kingdom, we are ordained. Ordination is entrance into professional freedom for ministers who stand fast in the freedom to which they have been called. How then does a minister of the Church of the Kingdom relate to current images of the clergy? Some images of the clergy current today have their source in cultural expectations, and all images are culturally conditioned. That is, the ministry can never be treated as purely an ecclesiastical affair. The simple fact that we speak of the ministry as a profession indicates that it has significant points of comparison with other occupational roles. There are also images of the ministry which are inherent to the Christian tradition itself, but quite foreign to the world's understanding of the clergyman. Likewise, a distinction must be made between the empirical church's expectations regarding the ministry and images of the ministry which are appropriate to the expectations of the kingdom of God. Ideally, the church's expectations and the kingdom's expectations would be identical, but as we have seen all too clearly, we do not live, we will not live, in an ideal church. Thus, images of the ministry might be understood in terms of three sets of expectations: cultural, ecclesiastical, and those derived from our understanding of the kingdom of God. These three, theoretically, are not in conflict with one another. Insofar as the church is faithful to the coming kingdom, and insofar as the culture cites its fulfillment in the kingdom promise, there exists a harmonious whole in which loyalty to the kingdom encompasses loyalty to the church and to the culture. However, both church and culture are myopic, and therefore, in order to gain immediate advantage, both church and culture will make demands upon the ministry, will distort its images in a way that does violence to the kingdom expectation. As a professional rule of thumb, it would seem to me that a minister should sift the demands made upon him, giving priority to the coming kingdom of God. The church should aid the minister in maintaining his priority, but frequently it fails to do so. Indeed, it is not at all infrequent that the culture is of more help than the church in alerting the ordered ministry to its kingdom responsibility. Finally, we note that the minister's person and placement will have some bearing upon the professional images to which he responds. An introvert may develop a different style of ministry from that of the extroverted operator. An inner city pastor will fulfill his ministry in a manner quite different from that of the seminary professor, and both will differ from the pastoral administrator of an upper-income suburban congregation. And all this is as it should be. Indeed, one of the problems with the ministry today is that we are plagued with rather narrow definitions of ministry. The suburban pastor feels guilty because he is not working with street gangs, and the theologian wonders if he has a minister because he is not counseling the unhappily married or comforting the dying. The romantic notion current in some circles that only the inner city pastor, who is really where the action is, really has a minister. And all of this is frequently distorted, distorted into an excuse for evading the demands of the kingdom in other areas of human existence and of ministerial responsibility. Briefly, I'd like to suggest that there are 10 distinct images of the ministry current today. Between some, the nuances may be rather slight, but nonetheless, worthy of note. Some of my thoughts are based on sociological study, some on personal observation, others on intuition. But I hope that what follows will provoke our reflection about the professional style appropriate to one who is devoted to the politics, to the social reordering of the new creation. First, there is the clergyman as authority figure within the religious community. In Lutheran circles, we think of Herr Pastor. The Roman Catholic might have in mind the stereotyped Father O'Reilly, who has cupped two parish generations on the year. For others, it might be an appearance in divine, a hellfire and brimstone rhetoric. This image of the ministry thrived where the religious community was coterminous with the congregation's actual community of discourse, such as in the German Lutheran settlements of the last century and in the Irish ghettos of the city. Such a ministry was dependent upon the illiteracy of the parish relative to the clergyman, and upon a cultural homogeneity, neither of which are prevailing marks of contemporary society. This authoritative style of ministry is still possible, no doubt, in certain rural areas, and it is definitely and dangerously possible in the ghettos of the inner city. One also sees signs of it in some upper-income parishes of successful, achievement-oriented people who want the church to give them a respectable experience of nostalgia for their childhood. In such parishes, there is a deference toward the ministry, a dependence pattern, such as one does not find, for instance, in the lower middle-income parish where everyone is on the make and parishioners want to call their pastor by his first name. We would be well rid of the Herr Pastor style, I think, since it encourages a kind of religious infantilism and is dependent upon the immaturity or escapism of the congregation. In the inner city, this style takes the shape of a paternalism which is not resented enough. Those who possess a degree of what is popularly termed charisma must be particularly careful. consistency between the message and the style of its medium if the message is to be credible. As we have seen, there is a great danger of magic and of superstition here. But perhaps part of that, at least, is the risk that must be run. The question, rather, is what does his difference signal? If his difference signals access to some occult powers, you see, to turn on God, then we have fallen into magic. If his difference signals a kind of moral superiority and aloofness from the harsh realities of everyday life, we have fallen into smugness and hypocrisy. But if the style of the pastor signals a liberated life, lived in response to a point of reference which transcends the petty inhibitions by which most men are held in bondage, then the difference of the priest scores a point for the coming kingdom of God. The third cluster of images in which the ministry is seen as a moral constabulary. Here we have our censors leading anti-pornography campaigns. Here we have our guardians of order and curators of social conventions. There is a high ecclesiastical and cultural demand for this style of ministry, but I think it almost totally offensive to the kingdom. I do not have in mind the valuable role of the church and of its ministry in calling men to moral constraint for the sake of a higher goal which dare not be jeopardized for the achievement of immediate ends. Such a call to constraint is in fact an affirmation of the future. But in this third cluster of images is an implied denial and fear of the future. In playing this role, the ministry is captive to the conservative elements in society who only stand to lose by change. This role of the ministry is marked by inane sloganeering about old-fashioned religion and preaching a changeless Christ for a changing was in yearning for history's promised fulfillment. An image of the ministry of more recent origin is that of the priest as provocateur. This revolutionary image is becoming more acceptable as more and more clergy begin to swing with the peace movement, with militant community organization, and with the dropout style of the various facets of the new left. There is a high kingdom demand. There is a significant cultural demand, and there is practically no ecclesiastical demand for this style of ministry. Needless to say, I think it is a style that deserves serious consideration. But there are dangers in connection with it. If the minister becomes a propagandist or a manipulator, he has sold out, and it does not matter that he did it for a good cause. When he's swinging with the creative periphery as faddish rather than reflective, when he loses his critical distance from the cause which he espouses, he has lost his significance as an agent of the coming kingdom. Then, too, he must maintain, as we mentioned before, a credible relationship to the church. There is a narrow but all-important difference between being a rebel and being a renegade. In the eyes of the world, a rebel is provocative, while a renegade is pitiful, something like being a whiskey priest. Then, too, we have a ministry through the church to turn it toward the kingdom. You can only subvert an organization,
and the loving subversion of the church is what I trust we are all about. You can only subvert an organization from the inside. The difficulty that some ministers have in this connection is due to their being theologically stranded, I think, on the false dichotomy of prophet versus priest. This dichotomy, essentially liberalism, that is to be given no more credence than the dichotomy between tradition and renewal. The priest provocateur is a growing breed, and it is too early to tell whether the style in the exercise, without selling out to something less than the kingdom, or without leaving the church in the lurch. I believe the priest provocateur is a hopeful image among the most hopeful in the church today. A fifth and problematic image of the ministry is that of a counselor therapist. I do, with deep misgiving, the ascendancy of pastoral psychology and clinical training.
something of the church is a sign of the human community, but quite another if it is simply an agency directed toward individual treatment through group therapy. In the former case, the church is a social signal of the kingdom hope, and in the latter, a rather shoddy psychological clinic. These remarks touch upon the larger questions of the conflict between the individual and society. Unlike its rival prophet of the kingdom, Marxism, Christianity does not disregard the value of the individual. And it is true that a healing community, which signals the hope for society's healing, should be a community in which individuals find fulfillment. It is at this point that pastoral psychology no doubt has a role, although one wonders if the role of the clergyman and of the church institution shouldn't be one primarily of professional referral. There are no doubt instances in which personal training and inclination may indicate that a particular minister's role ought to be that of psychologist, therapist. But the current notion that this is every minister's role, to a greater or lesser degree, is an escape and a discovery. In discovering that he does not have a clean-cut job description the way other men do, it is a distraction from the larger task of asserting and implementing the kingdom's claims in the shaping of society. European visitors frequently remark the religious attitude which many Americans have toward psychiatry. Therapy sessions are a form of liturgy, and the psychiatrist a cultic priest, with the usual overt undertones of superstition. Perhaps the rise of pastoral psychology in the seminary curriculum is to be explained in part by the clergyman's desire to reclaim this religious market on which he once had a monopoly. There is, of course, the role of a sales order and a father confessor, of a spiritual guide, and so forth, which is quite separate from what I have said with regard to the psychologist therapist. In any case, I agree with Gibson Winter when he says that the churches have become leaderless as clergy are diverted to endless individual cases. Of course, the clergy are attracted to this counseling role because the clergy have a kind of capture-in-the-rye complex, and they feel significant as helpers of the weak. The ministerial image of the counselor-therapist should be, I think, the exception rather than the rule in the Church of the Coming Kingdom. The sixth and more promising image of the ministry is that of the rabbi-teacher. Here is where the suburban parish and congregation with laity of a higher educational level can be especially strong. It is tragic that theology is often considered the preserve of those interested in that sort of thing. In large part, this is the fault of the theologians who inadvertently, or because they wish to protect their specialty, use a form of religious language which claims unwarranted privileges for itself. And tomorrow, I want to talk a little bit about the illusion that theology is an Archimedean point unconditioned by history. Let me make it very clear, however, what I mean positively by the clergyman as rabbi teacher. I do not mean that the clergyman should initiate people into the minutiae of biblical geography or denominational disputes. In most congregations, there is an abundance of lay
whose careers consist in moving adroitly through an organizational maze. This image of the ministry is not a particularly popular one, especially not among seminarians and younger pastors. Pastors frequently protest the time and the energy consumed by parish administration. Perhaps if the parish were really big business, more pastors would think of ministering it worthy of their talents. But most parishes, being what they are, the administrator's role is something like being a full-time executive for the religious version of the Kiwanis Club, and is resented by the clergy. The pastoral administrator role is compromising, it seems, for how can the organization's chief public relations officer really be honest? How can the man responsible also for the fiscal firmness of an organization risk the organization's stability by espousing an unpopular cause? The pastoral administrator seems to be the very antithesis to the kind of ministry of freedom which Paul Goodwin says is attracting young men today. Eugene Carson Blaine at the World Council recently said that he learned when he was a very young man that a certain amount of time was required in administration. So he said, I learned to do it well and quickly in order to get on to more important tasks. This is no doubt part of the answer. But we have all known unsure pastors who spend the whole day each week doing nothing but writing a Sunday bulletin, and others who complain about the endless meetings they must attend, but seem to believe that the trustees cannot discuss the plumbing in the boys' room without benefit of the pastor's theological insight. But viewing administration as a necessary evil which is to be minimized does not do justice, I think, to this image of the ministry. Thinking about the pastoral administrator role is often fogged by superficial talk about organization men and anti-institutionalism. The question is not whether I shall be an organization man, but of what kind of organization shall I be the man. I know a pastor, for instance, who complained endlessly about the administrative junk work he had to do in his parish. And the same man joyfully spent 3 days running off flyers and making telephone calls to promote an open occupancy drive in his neighborhood. Now, in doing this, he was an organizer, an administrator, a promoter, all things which he usually rejected. The difference was that in this case, he believed in what he was doing. I think I could be an organization man for the Friends Service Committee, but I cringe at the thought of doing the same thing for the American Legion. So we forget the jargon of anti-institutionalism and ask ourselves whether, in terms of what we consider important as priests of the Church, the parish is more like the Friends Service Committee or the American Legion. In most cases, parishes will be more like the American Legion, especially with regard to their eagerness for social change. Discovering this, we have the choice of either shaking the dust off our feet and going elsewhere, or of reorienting the organization. The latter is the course of parish renewal. Genuine parish renewal is a risky business in terms of career. Some advice Saul Alinsky once gave to a group of seminarians who wanted to know how they could contribute in the struggle for social justice applies here. He said, it's very simple, students, he said, very simple. When you go out that door, just decide for yourself whether you want to go through life as a priest or a bishop. And once you've made that decision, everything else will follow. Very briefly then, the eighth image of the ministry is that of the president of the assembly. This, of course, rather than a celebrant or officiant, is a primitive church's term for the one who presides upon liturgical action. The word president in our linguistic experience, of course, is usually combined with an executive function, similar to that of the administrator. But here we mean president as the one who presides. This, of course, assumes that there is an action over which he presides. The dismal shape of liturgical practice in many parishes is quite the opposite. The action seems to come from the pastor, and the congregation does the presiding. There's no more to say, however, that connection. Here the point is that the minister is the president of a kingdom community, and the liturgical focus of his role and of the community should be clear that it is to maintain its distinctiveness and its potential for provocation in a larger society. One can make a good historical case for the president role as the only one which is essential to the ordered ministry. The combining of sacramental order with jurisdiction, theological expertise, administration, etc., is not to be assumed and indeed ought to be re-examined. One begins then with a self-understanding as president and chooses the combination according to which he considers the best style for invoking the coming kingdom of God. You would want to take into account, and just to name them here, two more images much more familiar to us. That, the knight, the minister is the healer and the helper. Closely related, of course, to the counselor therapist role. And again, we must be wary of getting trapped by the catcher in the rye complex. The value of the healer helper role is that it underscores the importance of the individual, its danger, if that, as in the case of the hospital chaplain, for instance, it catches the fellow man when he is down and desperate, and thus tends at least to distort religion into being a last resort. There is even an element of demonic arrogance in this role. Especially in the inner city, we are both blessed and plagued by starry-eyed romantics and smug, white middle-class, well-intended souls who want to help the poor people. The irony in Jesus' story of the Last Judgment in Matthew 28, an irony usually overlooked, is that Jesus saw the poor, the disinherited, the hungry, and the naked as the ones who were really doing the help. The others had to come to them to find him. Only when we learn that we enter the kingdom of heaven by permission of the poor do we see the inadequacy and the dangers of the healer-helper image. And then, a more familiar image yet, that of the minister of the word. The minister is a man held captive by the word of Jesus, the word about the kingdom and its promise in Jesus. He is freed by this vision which will not let him go, the vision of a new humanity, a new heaven, and a new earth, the fulfillment of history. If he is ordained, he will be president of the assembly that celebrates that visionary word. How else he will professionally encompass and proclaim that word is in large part dependent upon his personality, his placement, his courage. If he is a holy man and a sign of all men's future in freedom, if he is a provocateur, if he is an organizer and a rabbi, the rabbi of revolutionaries, then he is, I think, the minister at his very best, a professional practitioner of the politics of the kingdom. Thank you. As you might notice, we're having the benefit of having a tape of this presentation so that we might get more specifically and verbatim. We're open now for approximately 30 minutes for comments, questions on this presentation. I'll ask everyone else to field his own questions from you. I got through the whole thing only one thing bothered you. Of a beneficent future, that the human history is destined toward a fulfillment that is essentially good, and the understanding of which always remains very provisional and preliminary and inadequate, but the certainty of its coming, of God's keeping his promise, remains to be just and needed if it is the dynamic of the whole church's life. Basically Christian eschatology, the second coming of Christ, but not as an event against history or outside of history, but as the fulfillment of the historical process of which we are part, of which Jesus was part, and of which his resurrection was the clue to its absolute future and the deficit. I think that if we understand the kingdom of God properly, that it gives a new sense of urgency to the present. And so we do not see the concern as being one where we have to make a choice between getting involved in this world now, religiously, okay, or concern about the kingdom of God. For the kingdom of God is the fulfillment of the stuff which comprises our lives and the lives of all humanity now. Maybe I you told me. And I think that one of the great problems in much Christian thought, perhaps especially in Lutheran thought, which has this unfortunate influence of a bifurcated notion of two kingdoms, that we have become not only rather hesitant to speak about the absolute future of God's promise, but we have become almost cynical about the utopian climate. I don't think Jesus was either hesitant or cynical about it. I think that we have to recapture that sense of urgency. Maybe that all of life and of the moon can only be understood in terms of its future. There is nothing which I do which holds its meaning in itself. Okay? I think this is the basic insight, you see. The character who's taking LSD trips, you see, or the person who is engaging in the more exciting and bizarre aspects of Oriental religious experience, or the person who lives by the force of his fantasies, sexual and evil fantasies and otherwise, such a person seeks in a moment to capture eternity, to have eternity in the hope. Like what Jesus says, that eternity is not now for the having and the hope, but the story is not yet complete. The story will be completed in the kingdom of God. Now what we have, that is the most fascinating, like, the church can make for the society because we live in a time in which rational men believe there's no reasonable. I think the church's role is to come along and to say to reasonable men who really are seeking first the kingdom of God, whether they've ever heard about Jesus or not, who really are seeking the fulfillment of God's purpose in the world, and for the church to come along and not to disillusion them about their utopian thinking, you know, and say, buddy, you aren't realistic enough and you don't take Auschwitz and Buchenwald seriously enough, and you don't realize how horrible and distorted, you know, is this evil configuration of God's humanity, etc. That's not the church's role. And then to get the guy, you know, thoroughly discouraged so that we can then tell him some good news about some fulfillment outside of history or against history. But rather, it seems to me the church's contribution is to give a reasonable foundation to man's universal hope. To come along and to say to such a man, whether he be Christian or not, yes, you are right, you see. And there's more to it than you think there is, you see. And here's why. Here's all about Jesus and what he said, what he did, what happened to him. And why it seems, you know, to us, to say to himself, that he is the picture of the universal man of the future. And therefore, why this person struggling and striving and utopian dreams and humanistic commitments, you see, why, therefore, all of it is rational. Why all of it is reason. It is confirmed that God's action in Jesus Christ, not denied. So, utopian, unquestioned. That's the sense of it. I think that's the sense of it.
You spoke about false life and sense of that time that you've heard before.
idea, much of it's saying, I know where Protestantism today. That it's very, very difficult. I'll talk about this in the last of the three talks, to get people to understand how liturgy is related to social change. Because to most people, it just seems, my gosh, if there's anything esoteric, you know, purely to be put off in some kind of corner of the museum for people who happen to have time to go through that kind of thing, it's liturgy. Grad social change, that's a real, that's a stuff. And yeah, I get that real prophet priest kind of clash again. So, and I think that it's neither supported, as I understand, by contemporary biblical scholarship. I think it's certainly not supported by sociological insight into the role of cult in provoking people's images and points of reference for change. Yeah, that statement is from Gibson Winter at the University of Chicago. I think what he's saying is that so many clergymen, and there are numerous studies to support this, feel a great loss in terms of their professional identification. You know, and you talk with clergy, for instance, and I know one guy who's a hospital chaplain, and really, I mean, he's pretty, and he's been through enough therapy so that he knows what's going on. He really, all his life, wanted to be a medical doctor. And he's being a hospital chaplain is a kind of surrogate role, you know. It's a very strange kind of thing in a way. And there's this feeling, you know, as he says, if a doctor walks into the operating room, and then he knows precisely what he's going to do, or at least he gives the appearance that he does, you know. And he has certain rules, and certain things he moves, and cuts, and ties, you know. And it's all very neat and stuff, mechanical, you know. And then after he's done, here comes in the process. This feeling of being important, you know, and it's enormously satisfying. There's nothing more satisfying, you know, than to have people say, fasting, you don't know how much you did for me, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Gibson Winter's point is that that's an enormous temptation, then, you see, to begin to relate to that role almost as a dominant role in a man's ministry. Now, as I tried to make clear, there are unquestionably guys who ought to be professionally therapists, counselors, you know, and so forth. Unquestionably. Just as we ought to have priests who are experts in labor relations, you know, and in arbitration. And just as we ought to have priests who are experts in poverty programs, you know, and so forth, you see. But, I mean, the problem is that we've got an image of the ministry here, which is assumed as universal application. And that, I think, no, if someone's doing it, you see, you ought to not to do it well and get over it, but you have to do it very carefully. But what ought he to do? If he really is a professional and really equipped to seriously approach this task of counseling and therapy, okay, then he ought to take great care and do it as a professional. If he's not, he ought very professionally to refer and get about the business which he can best do. I think that's very crucial. There's numerous pastors whose ministries are in many ways eaten up. And although they feel tremendously dissatisfied and so forth, it's highly questionable whether it was the best use of their time, whether there were not things worse, they were much, much better for. Whether it was not a, you know, desperate dependence upon the satisfaction that comes from that particular role. Right there.
several ways. I think the notion of the future determining the present, I'd say it can be talked about, not demonstrated, of course, but talked about meaningfully in purely philosophical terms. And here I would particularly confess my indebtedness to Wolfhard Pannenberg, who in turn has in many ways developed some of the thoughts and lines of thought suggested by Whitehead, particularly in Huxley. So I think that, see, just man's reflection upon reality itself suggests this nature of this idea of a generative future, okay, which is really what the kingdom is all about, namely that the future has a power which is relating to the present, okay, and which obviously, therefore, is the power of love, for it is the very power of relationship. All right, now then I think one can look in human history and sense moments, okay, within our own personal experience of great love, of great inspiration, of great noble deed, either in our part or done toward us, and so forth, in which we say, you know, that was real. It's very important to say that we say that was real, because we are, I think, betraying something very true about ourselves. We're saying something, reflecting something very true. And that is that which is most real is that which is most hopeful. All right? Now, however, I just turned it around, okay? As a Christian, I think that Christians would speak from the standpoint of philosophy, from the standpoint of psychology, which is this matter of personal experience and self-consciousness, I think Christians would speak from the standpoint of comparative religion and of the history of religion, a whole notion of man's attitude toward the future as being the object of anxiety and hope as being that which is both contingent and unitive. But he finally speaks as a Christian when he speaks in terms of the teaching of Jesus of Nazareth with regard to the culmination of God's purposes, all of which would not be very important, that is, his teachings would not be very important, if we did not believe that he was vindicated. And this, I think, is why the resurrection plays such a key role. That in some sense, it was very clear within our history, within our human history, that there was a community of people utterly committed to the proposition that what Jesus of Nazareth had proclaimed was vindicated by his own personal experience of victory over death and their experience of him after death. And I think that, therefore, we must take with enormous seriousness. Not because it's theological orthodoxy or anything like that. It's nothing we have to believe, okay? But just because I think there's an awful lot of very persuasive evidence that in some sense what Jesus of Nazareth proclaimed, okay, has by history itself been not proven, okay, only the end of time will prove it, but has been suggested to be true, namely by his resurrection. By Meredith and by the witness of the community consequent upon the resurrection. So I think it's a worldview, you see, and it is to be discussed. And maybe wrong, you see. Maybe Jesus was wrong, okay? And only history will tell us whether he's wrong. And now we have to have the courage of our uncertainties to follow on through. I think he's right. I'm rather persuaded. Certainly. In fact, we're talking about time, and I don't know if I'm talking, certainly the relating of, events, a series of events which constitute our experience of time, or at least when we reflect upon it, constitute time. Yeah, the Christian now, everybody participates in the same history, right? There is but one history, the universal history, right? In a sense, okay? Now, everyone is at different levels of consciousness and of awareness and so forth, all of which constitute his own history and the history of the community which shares his way of interpreting its experience at certain points, etc. So that within this diversity, there's nevertheless one time that's important, okay? Now, I realize that's a rather contrary point. Christians, I think, are different in this respect. And that Christians believe that in communion with Jesus, you the presence of God. Obviously, the kingdom of God has not come in its fullness. I think we have to be extremely careful, you know, in talking about the kingdom of God having come. The story of the old Hasidic rabbi in East Poland, you know, who was in his library studying the manuscripts and so forth, and he grabs one of his disciples, and he says, Rabbi, the Messiah has come, you know. And the rabbi slowly gets up out of his chair, you know, and he looks out the window and he says, no, he hasn't come. Everything is the same. That insight is that when he comes, all right, when this is really the truth, when the Christian gospel is true, everybody will know it. It won't be a question of faith, it will be a question of sight. I think that's something that Christians have often forgotten. We have talked too glibly about how now, you know, we are in the kingdom of God, or we are doing the work of the kingdom of God, and so forth, or the kingdom of God has come in Jesus. Now we see in a mirror, didn't we, you know, and it's a very provisional, a very preliminary thing. And we may be wrong. And that's, I think, what Christians have to be prepared to say. We may be wrong. We have to just throw this out for discussion. And the church's contribution to the world is to throw out this for discussion, all right, and say, look, we find it pretty persuasive. What do you think of it? And to stop, you know, trying, instead of throwing it out for discussion, shoving it down, throw it. All right. It's not been proven, and it may be proven wrong, but we have to be prepared to risk ourselves. Outside of the inner city situation, you know, something like that. Well, I'm very in poor form as an avant-garde clergyman, because I rather believe in the parish. I rather believe in its high potential. I rather believe in the suburban parish in upper white, you know, middle income Brookville, Long Island. At least I think it has real possibilities. In a sense, look what you got there. Here you've got, I mean, a rather unique institutional phenomenon. Maybe 150 or 500, as the case may be, people who come together regularly in one place with a fair degree of regularity, and who claim that this coming together is intimately connected with the most important things in their lives. You know, God, life, death, salvation, hope, meaning, you know, the whole bit, you see. And who claim that their loyalty to what is being shared here in the preaching and in the songs and in the rites and in the ceremonies is really definitive for their existence. That's what they're saying all the time. Man, what an exciting thing. You know, here you got these 150 people, right, on a regular kind of basis, making all kinds of extravagant claims about what this means to them, you know, and you can call their bluff, you know, and you have a tradition to do it with, you see. And that's a beautiful thing. I think that, as well as trying to get at the earlier part of this thing, the tradition we got's a lively tradition. You know, it's full of the most fanatical, radical, visionary, upsetting, disturbing, refreshing kinds of insights, you know, and points of references in the whole of human history. Indeed, anything else that's exciting in the world today, and I want to talk about this a little bit more tomorrow afternoon, in the relationship between the Christian faith and democracy. You take all the political.
clergy of all you know, they talk about God is dead and the death and everything conceivable. It's much more fascinating to clergy. And a lot of that is attributable to their kind of identity crisis, role crisis, not knowing who we are. And so we decided, you know, it would be iconoclast. But not a bad place too, but it's not a very adequate image.
Serving a radical